And now, Dan Happel's Connecting the Dots.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, where the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away.
Forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. 'Cause there ain't no doubt,
I love this land.
God bless the USA.
God bless the USA.
The CIA, Jim, they obviously, you've got some really important stuff to say. And they don't want you on here talking about it. That's obviously what's happening. It happens exactly. Most of the time. So, all right, well, nice to see you on there, Jim. God bless you, brother.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, he's an interesting man. And like I say, Jim worked internationally. He was working on with various international agencies on the fur trade. They were trying to shut down internationally the fur trade. He met with Europeans and all over. He knows a lot of the Russian biologists and people that were involved in this stuff. He's so tuned in on this stuff. And they don't like hearing what he's got to say, because, in fact, I don't know anybody in the wildlife and biology area that has more information than Jim Beard. He's good. Jim, welcome to the program. I see you're muted. Go ahead and unmute yourself, and please join us. And, wow, I'm so tickled you finally figured out how to get on this thing. You and I've had, I don't know how many Zoom calls together, and we've never had this kind of problem. And you mentioned that this has been happening a lot more often. It's happening to all of us, because they don't want to hear what we've got to say. Jim, I did a quick introduction, but also on top of that, you were a line officer in the U.S. Navy, and you were when you were with Fish and Wildlife. I want you to kind of describe what happened when you started to do a little whistleblowing on the fact that they were using federal funds that were targeted for enhancing fishing and hunting and wildlife use for hunters and fishermen. And that was being taken and used in introducing Canadian gray wolves to the Yellowstone ecosystem. Anyway, welcome to the program, Jim. Please, let's start there. That gives our listeners a little bit of a chance to get to know you better.
Okay, I was hired by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the late 1960s when I got out of the Navy. And I was kind of all over the place, wound up in Washington for about 30 years. So I've got a lot of background with wildlife management and the way the politics works in Washington, whatever. And I noticed, as a wildlife biologist, I noticed that under the Carter administration, a lot of people that did not like to manage wildlife that were against hunting, and that started to be getting higher. Under the auspices mostly of EEO, there was just a big thing about minorities and women that all of a sudden brought a lot of people in because of that. And they were urban people, and they tended to have strong feelings against what we were doing. But it got really bad when Clinton got elected. And I saw that all of a sudden there was a big bunch of these people running key jobs because they'd been hired at grade levels in that for this the service. And it and when he got elected is when Gingrich first came in into office and was the Speaker of the House. Republicans, mm-hmm. for the first time in 40 years, had the House. So I noticed at that time, which was about 2 years into the Clinton administration, that the annual money that we collected, the Fish and Wildlife Service collected, for state fish and wildlife agencies operations, been going on for since the 1930s, called Pittman Robertson and Dingell Johnson, that money should have been taking a big uptick because the Clinton people at first said they were going to ban guns. And it was what we just saw with Obama and what we've seen even more with Biden. People said, well, I'm going to buy my guns. I'm going to buy ammunition. I'm going to put it away and blah, blah, blah. So we had all kinds of more money coming in. But all of a sudden, for 2 to 3 years, there was less money available for the state fish and wildlife agencies. And I thought that was pretty squirrely. Well, it came time for them, the new people tried to ban trapping and the use of furs in the United States and make it an international thing to put us in Canada and Russia out of the fur business and to close down the fur business because that was what they thought was real important, even though it's a big tool for wildlife management. So anyway, when they did that, they came after me because I had been going to Europe and was all of a sudden successful in getting the Europeans to drop their efforts to pull the rug out from under us by saying, oh, you can't trap any animal unless you use humane methods that we approve. And they didn't have any intention of ever approving anything. But be that as it may, they came after me. They said they were going to transfer me to Boston. And they didn't know what the job was going to be, but, you know, that whatever. And I had three kids going to college at the time. My wife had a job there in Virginia, and we were just trying to make it 2 days. So anyway, it got to be a big knockdown, drag-out fight between me and the government, actually Fish and Wildlife Service. And they told me to go home, and they would get a hold of me. And while I was there, I got called by the House Resources Committee, U.S. House of Representatives, and they asked me, Jim, what's going on there? And I told them about the fur thing and all of that, and I said, well, these people are after me. And I said, once the strange thing happened, too, under this Clinton people, I said, I told them about the money from the gun excise taxes, mm-hmm. and ammunition. It was a lot of millions and millions of dollars. And they said, oh, and I explained to them how it could only be used by law by state agencies. So I said, something's kind of funny here. Okay, thanks. So they told me to go home, and about a week later, about a month and a half later, they called me and asked me to come up there. I was still at home. I had hired a lawyer, and he was trying to deal with my future with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And they asked me to come in, and the general accounting office was there, and they had these 19 big boxes that are about 2 feet high that have printouts in them. And they said, you know what that is? And I said, no. They said, that's all the money that the Fish and Wildlife Service spent in the years 1994, 1995, and 1996. They told us that was the only way they could give it to us. It's all the refuge money and the fish hatchery money and all of this other stuff, law enforcement money. They said they couldn't separate it, which was a lie. They could have separated it with the computer power they had at the time. But anyway, I told them, I said, well, that's interesting. They said, would you take a look at a few of them and see what they look like? And I said, well, yeah, I'm getting paid. I'm sitting at home, sure. And I came in there and I went through them for a day and I found out that they had diverted a lot of money. I told the Resources Committee staff that. They got the General Accounting Office and a bunch of accountants to work with me, and I worked with them for a period of almost a month and a half after that. And they came up with an accounting report that said $45 to $60 million was missing from those funds. And the money used to trap wolves in Canada, transport them into Yellowstone Park before anybody knew what was going on, and releasing them to the upper Rocky Mountain areas, that was where it looked like most of the money went. So I verified that, and they spent some of the money that they had left over giving it to people that didn't deserve it, top managers in the Fish and Wildlife Service, in their bonuses, and in hiring a young lady who was the daughter of a senator at an office they had opened with some of the money in California. I mean, it was so corrupt, you couldn't believe it. And anyway, they had an accounting report on that. They had two big hearings. The director refused to come to one of the hearings and sent her deputy and said that, well, she had to go on a trip to Hawaii. She, you know, got business there. She'll be back. And luckily, when the Republicans were still in power, the chairman, a guy by the name of, what's his name in Northern California, said, if she's not here next Tuesday, we're going to find her in contempt of Congress, and we're going to really make this into something big. So anyway, long story short, they documented, and the service said that their lawyers told them that they could use the money however they wanted to. But the truth was, it said right in the law, it could only be used by the state fish and wildlife agencies. So they stole the state fish and wildlife money to put the wolves in after Congress had told them, while Gingrich was in there, they would not fund or authorize wolf reduction or wolf introductions in Yellowstone or anywhere else in the West. They did it anyway. They all got away with it. The wolves got out. The people who were in charge that were lost their job when Bush got elected all went on to bigger jobs with the NGOs, and everything was copacetic. And the big kicker is the state Fish and Wildlife Agency directors, who have their own big lobby group, never complained about it. One of them even tried to, Jim, can I talk to you a minute? Took me off to the side once in a meeting and said, you know, this was a lot of mistakes made here. And, you know, it would help us a lot if you would just kind of explain that this is not what it appears to be. It was just an accounting mistake. I said, go to hell. You know, I didn't want to talk to somebody like that. But the state Fish and Wildlife Agency guys, who you think represent you and I think represent me, no, they're just top-level bureaucrats that depended on federal largesse and money and favors and everything else. So the wolves are off to the races. They're still all over the place. They're still in and out of court. It's still a big mess, and it's getting bigger all the time. They gave them the incentive to do the same thing with grizzly bears. We know what's happening with them. And they're trying to do the same thing now with buffaloes, prairie reserves, the whole nine yards. They're making their big moves with using big government and politics. And I've been writing about that a lot, and I'm trying to write some solutions for it that I think. And I think that's one of the reasons I had trouble getting on with you this morning. I think a lot of people are pretty upset about what I've been writing. So that's mm-hmm. it. As small a nutshell as I can make it.
Yeah, well, you're having a tough time on your internet, and I understand. What we're talking about here, and incidentally, they tried to fire you for doing the whistleblowing that you did. You went through, you were pretty much out of the agency for about a year, year and a half.
That's correct, yep.
And finally, they ended up having to settle and pay you a pile of money, but at the same time, they force you to retire in agreement that, you know, they would settle with you. You had to retire, and they put a whistleblower muzzle on you for 3 years. Talk a little bit about
that. That's correct.
Please.
I was home for 10 months. My daughter, during that time, one of my daughters was working on a PhD in chemistry, and she was doing postdoctoral work over in Germany. So I called my lawyer up, and I said, my wife and I want to go visit my daughter in Germany. Do I need to put in for leave? I said, since I'm working from home or whatever they think I'm doing for all these 10 months. He said, no. He says, you go do that. He says, I'll take care of him here. You don't have to ask for nothing. He said, everything is going fine. And it was. I came back. They offered me the 3-year, 6-figure settlement number. I get a payment each of the 3 years, but I had to agree not to talk, write, or in any way infer anything about my last 3 years in the U.S. government, Fish and Wildlife Service. or they would take all the money back from me. So think about this. They were using taxpayer money, everybody's taxpayer money, to pay a guy like me to keep his mouth shut, not to talk to a reporter, not to write about anything, not to speak about to a bunch of ladies that are interested in conservation or a bunch of hunters or anything. Think about that. They used taxpayer money to make me keep my mouth shut about what we were just talking about. I couldn't, there was a lot of things that I learned during that period. That was one of the big surprises there to me. I didn't think that he could even do things like that. Yeah.
Well, and with that, I mean, you'd been with the various agencies for close to 30 years. So it wasn't like you were, you know, some new guy on the block that didn't know where to look for all this information. You knew exactly where to look. And you had the audacity, because the Clinton administration did a lot of this stuff kind of under the table, because they weren't given the money or the mandate to do this stuff. But under the so-called sustainable development stuff, this part of UN Agenda 21, they started implementing a lot of programs in the United States through the agencies, and this was where some of the stuff was coming from. And you found a lot of that, didn't you?
I did. And since that happened, I've seen more and more of it happen. You got a period where the Bush people came in and they kind of got along with everybody and didn't seem to move things too much one way or the other. Then all of a sudden you got the Obama bunch came in and they took off again in a very rabid environmental, animal welfare, no logging direction. And then now we've got this wokeism and the people that are doing that. I've seen this progress into bigger and bigger things all the time. And more people are doing very corrupt, wrong things. And I'm not just talking about presidents here. And nobody's ever punished. So it just gets to be more and more abusive, bigger and bigger. You know, it's like the kid that starts stealing lunch money when he's in fifth grade. Then the next thing you know, he's kind of beating up kids to take their whatever he wants from them. And then we're all surprised when he's sticking up a 7-Eleven and shooting at a policeman. You know, it's just gone like that. Things are very, very bad. And I see it, because of my background, really, as starting a lot with the environmental movement and all of these agencies, the Forest Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the BLM, all of them in cahoots with their counterparts in the states that see this all going on and know that they've got to nod and be nice, or they won't get endangered species money or grant money, or their university won't be able to have the world's biggest expert on mountain lions, and blah, 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 and all of this kind of stuff. It just increased to dramatic proportions. And as I write about it, and I don't speak about it as much as I used to because I'm getting a little older, and the travel and everything, but it's something that I really lose sleep about, trying to think about solutions. And I've got one that I keep coming up with that I'm starting to write about more and more. And I think, like I said earlier in this, I think that's what precipitated this sort of initial blockage that I couldn't get through to you.
Yeah. Well, like you and I said earlier, I mean, we've been on a number of podcasts together over the years. And matter of fact, I met you when we were going through trying to get the delisting of wolves in the state of Montana, because there were so many packs of wolves in Montana, and they were really, really becoming a problem with the cattle ranchers, with livestock production. They were a real problem, and they still are, frankly, in certain areas. But now that at least people have the chance to shoot at them, they're becoming a lot more reclusive in their back and out of areas. But there was a time, and that's how, like I say, how I met you, through our good friend Bob Fanny. And you came, and I was a county commissioner at the time, and we did a presentation in Helena, as a matter of fact, that you did a program on exactly what we're talking about now at the state capitol. in the one of the auditoriums there for the Livestock Commission.
Yep, I remember that well. And they've got some real problems. They still do. And their problems are spreading even in here in the Midwest. And in, right now they're putting them into Colorado, and people are saying, oh, they're going to crossbreed with the Mexican wolves and all of this nonsense. There are literally millions of wolves in the northern hemisphere of the world, okay? Mm-hmm. So to say they're endangered is nuts. But to say that they're endangered and we've got to put them everywhere in the western states and the southern states and that because they were once there is just simply unheard of tyrannical power in the hands of federal bureaucrats and politicians. The fact that they say, oh, you've got to have them in Montana and you've got to have them in there. Colorado now wants to put them in. It's just nuts because, like you say, they are very difficult. They're very harsh economically on ranchers and ranching and livestock and dogs. And if, in fact, you're worried about wolves, and I'm not, but be that as it may, if you really are concerned about wolves, the more wolves you get in these concentrated areas in Europe, here in the United States, in Canada, and in Asia, even in China, down into India and all of Siberia, okay, they're all over the place there. The more the densities increase, the more interbreeding you get with coyotes, jackals, and all kinds of domestic dogs, okay? Mm-hmm. They kill them and eat them when they want to, but if one's in heat, they get bred. And you can get wolves, a wolf bitch carrying the pups out in the wilderness, or you can get some guy with his favorite German shepherd that the dog got pregnant. And there's a lot of that going on. So the genetic identification of wolves is getting more and more mysterious. And on top of it, wolves, coyotes, and dogs, all dogs, and dingoes, if they get a chance, can interbreed and have puppies just like you get when you cross a Labrador with a golden retriever. You get this thing that's a little bit of each, but it's still a dog, whatever. And there, what is a dog? What is a species? What is a coyote as opposed to a wolf? People that really, a good friend of mine that died a couple of years ago in British Columbia, he was a professor. That was his big concern was he said, wolves are going to disappear. He said, why do we want that? That doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't. But in the meantime, the only thing they're doing is they're putting ranchers out of business. They're making it harder to make a living in rural America. And they're just difficult. They're hard on everybody in rural America, like so many things you see going on with the Clinton administration and then the Obama administration and now the Biden administration. So many hard things, whether it's population control to please the World Economic Forum, or just simply getting people out of the rural areas where they cannot be controlled like they can if they're all living in condos in the urban areas and, yep. Going to work in a Uber or riding in the subway somewhere, hoping they're not going to get killed. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what it is.
Well, if I may, I have a question for you, but I'm more concerned about the jackals that we have in Washington, D.C. Can we do something about, eliminating them? I mean, if we could have some kind of control on getting it. But first, I want to commend you on not taking the money. That is, a tip of the hat to you. There are so many people. I'm going to ask you a question, and I've asked this to a lot of people that are like yourself in the services, in the government services, and they're coming across what you have experienced. But percentage-wise, what would you say, how many people are corrupted to the point where they would take the money or just coerced into remaining silent and going along with the game? How many of you are there out there, Jim, and as opposed to the people that are going along with a game?
Well, if you think I did not take those three installments, you'd be wrong. I did take them because my wife and I had to get out of there, and it was really causing a lot of strain for us. And my kids in college, was putting a big economic drain on me, and I had planned to work for another 5 or 6 years at least. So anyway, I did take that money, and I kept quiet for 3 years. And then it was Katie bar the door. But
Did they try to come and take the money back from you?
No, I took the money they offered me.
Oh, well, okay then. I mean, hey, nothing against that either, too. I'm glad to see that. Well, that's probably trying to attack you now with your Zoom thing and watching to get out there.
Well, I think what you said at first is one of the best points anybody can ever take from this discussion. And that is, how do you affect change of what's going on? The politicians are corrupt. The bureaucrats are all, I guess, progressive liberal oriented about the environment. And they think that socialist approaches to it, where they can control all of the property and all of the water, and that is where they want to be. So they're all almost religiously committed to putting commercial fishermen out of business, getting the ranchers off the land out there, having control of all the land except for the urban areas where their mayor will run it and control people. So with that description of it, I've come to the conclusion that it's mainly a political problem. I live in Minnesota. I don't have a single Republican. I'm not being pro-Republican or anti-Democrat here. I'm just saying I don't have a single Republican between me and the White House and the president. All Democrats, okay? So we tend to have Minnesota tends to have a strong view of that. So when people tell me, well, Jim, you ought to write your senator and tell her blah, blah, blah. I mean, I got to laugh, okay? So what is it that can solve this? It's a political problem. The government's got to solve it somehow. Well, the only ones that are going to keep the ranchers on the land, keep the commercial fishermen fishing, keep hunting going, keep work for our Second Amendment rights, is somebody with political power that is accountable to rural Americans. Mm-hmm. Rural Americans need help. Because every time this stuff comes up for a vote, look at Colorado with wolves, it's the voters in Colorado Springs and Denver and Fort Collins that, you know, outvote everybody else. So, I mean, how do you overcome that? It's the same in Washington State, in Oregon. Voters don't have the rural people that are the ones we're concerned with when we talk here, because they've got to live with logging being shut down, wolves that are protected or kept in thick numbers. How do we deal with that? A lot of the bureaucrats aren't going to help us, and none of the real politicians at the state or federal level are really committed to us for those purposes. None of them. I mean, some of them know about it and occasionally give their help to it, but they're so outnumbered in the process that they can't. So what I've been toying with and trying to come up and say to people, and when I write, is I'd like to suggest that each state that is concerned about its rural population and its rural natural resources, that they make a new office in their state capital for a commissioner or representative in charge of renewable natural resources for the state. Works with the governor on natural resources in the state. And what does the state mean for him? It means two or three or four voting blocks called renewable natural resource zones, where you and I could vote for the guy that's going to be in Helena or in Phoenix, and we can vote for another guy or gal for our district, which is a voting district made up of counties mostly, two or three or four for the state, exclusive of the urban concentration area. And you vote for you or me running for that position, whose commitment is to managing and using the renewable natural resources of the district, except for the guy in the Capitol who is working with the governor and the legislature for the state as a whole. And we've got somebody we elected. He's got to talk about this stuff. He's in there, or she's in there, to protect users, whether it's cattlemen grazing cattle, whether it's hunters paying a lot of money for elk licenses or moose licenses or whatever, or controlling wolves or grizzly bears, or seeing where they're put and where they're not going to be tolerated, and getting the state to do that, and then to force the state as much as they can, the guy in the Capitol and the ones that are the zone commissioners, get the state to stand up to the federal government about how they do not need to tolerate, the state doesn't need to tolerate unjust things that the federal government wants to do, or its upcoming meeting with the UN or the CITES group about listing more species and everything. And the money for it, you know, say, oh, it's going to be a lot of money. You take the money out of the Fish and Game Department funding and personnel in the state that are in that zone and in the Capitol, a proportionate amount, and you give them to these two or three or four people who form kind of a board in the state, the head guy and the zone guys, who you elect because they said, you're darn right, I'll stand up about this wolf thing. We will get the logging going back in there. We're going to be concerned about the logging mills. We're going to see that they get a tax break to get started and blah, 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 and a whole range of things that you don't have. We don't have anybody we can turn to now. And you as a rancher, me as a hunter, Dan as a fisherman or whatever, we blend our concerns together, and we have somebody we elect in the system that is concerned about the management and sustainable use, I guess for no better term, the real sustainable use of these things, to make them, conserve them and preserve them in settled landscapes. I mean, that's where I'm just giving you a thumbnail view of it. But I'm thinking that it's the only reasonable answer to the way we've been overpowered and made second-class citizens in rural America.
Yeah, well, that's a good
running
point.
For office? Have you ever thought about running for office?
Yes, I have. And I could not find a single person that I know here in the state of Minnesota to help me. Okay, and I'm telling you that just flat out. I could not find a guy that would even help me, a gal that watched the money or something. So
you know that what you represent is the biggest threat to the powers that should not be. The last thing they want are people that are self-sustaining, that can live off the land. Independent farmers, cattlemen, people that are independent and outside of the control of the cities or anything. You really do represent the biggest threat to those powers. And that's why they are attacking you so hard. That's why they're going to go after the independent people so hard. When I'm on the street doing my deal, my interviews, and I run across independent farmers all the time, ranchers all the time, and I listen to the stories of how they're being, they're just being attacked from six ways to Sunday. To go ahead and, you know, driving them out. And who's coming in and buying up their land? The Bill Gateses and the communists.
Right. Yep.
That's exactly right. Well, Jim, you were telling me before we got on air that you've put together a lot of information you wanted to share with our viewers and our listeners. I'm going to give you as much an open format as I can to allow you to do that. But, you know, you saw the announcement that I sent out, and I started talking about engineered famine. And that's really what we are talking about right now, is that we're talking about getting family farms and ranches off the landscape, turning everything into corporate agriculture that's easily controlled, the Monsantos and the big groups that will literally own everything. Bill Gates is now got somewhere around 500,000 acres that he's picked up. These are going to be the kind of people that are going to run the food production. And frankly, right now, we've got a lot of problems with that. We've had over 200. I think the latest number that I saw was somewhere in the 230s. Food facilities, major food facilities that have either burned down or otherwise been destroyed over the last 2 years. This is unprecedented because, you know, normally you might have one or two a year that burn down or go down, but now it's in the hundreds, and this is unusual. Everything is gearing us right now, the cost of farming, cost of fuel for farming, the cost of machinery for farming, everything that's happening is designed to get family ranching and farming and different productions off the landscape. And of course, number one on that list is cattle ranchers. So I'm kind of setting a little bit of a groundwork because I think this is an area you're going to go into. Jim, take it from here, please.
Yeah, I when we talked about my perhaps coming on the program the other day, you mentioned the Prairie Reserve System, and we've talked in the past about buffalo. They're two real big tools or weapons that the government's going to use to try to vacate people that are on the land and producing food in that. The prairie concern about all the prairies are going to disappear along with the wolves if we don't do all this nonsense. That the prairies are exactly what you ranch and what ranchers use, what cattle eat, and it's exactly it. But somehow we're being told, and the little kidlets are being prepared for, oh, if we don't do something, it's going to be like climate change and the world's going to come to an end, da-da-da-da-da. So they want to buy more land and stop people from using it, whatever. And the buffalo are just kind of like the frosting on the birthday cake. The buffalo got to roam all over the place and be out in the middle of the road as your wife's coming home at 11 o'clock at night from a meeting in town, and a dark buffalo's out there, and bang, she hits it going 45, 50 miles an hour or more, you know, and gets killed or maimed or whatever. Or they go into your garden, or they go into your crops, or they knock down your fences. Just make it like the wolves. Just make everything harder and harder and more worrisome and stressful to live out there and do anything with. Those are all political weapons that they're using to like you say, going after ranchers, but they're going after the loggers. They're going after the wildlife people and the wildlife users because they don't want anybody out there using it. They don't want people like me to have a gun. They don't want people to have a car or a truck that can go out there and go to a camp somewhere and be there and help haul some meat out when they get done or whatever. They don't, you know, they want you an electric vehicle that can't work good in the cold weather and all the other stuff. We're just in sort of a mania of Chicken Little, you might call it, in the country, where all of these things are just so important that we lose more and more sight of the fact, well, isn't that where the ranchers are? Well, what happens when those forests get all mature and it's all shaded out and there's no undergrowth for birds or for this or that? Or you forget all about that, but they don't want you thinking about it because they don't care about it. What they care about is pleasing the people in the World Economic Forum, the Bill Gates, who are supporting the politicians that support their agency and that hold the hearings that allow them to make statements that are shaped by universities that are affected by being told they'll get this big grant if they can show that the mountain lions never do this, or that it's possible that we may be able to make some grizzly bears into herbivores or some nonsense like that, and deny that, like with sharks. Right now they've banned, I think, 15 species of shark fishing at all anywhere in the world under CITES. And how did they do that? Well, they've got figures. They've got population figures that show they're all decreasing. And, well, it's not true, but it's the shark professors that know that's how you get your money and how you can help them play down all of this. There's more and more shark attacks, and there's more and bigger sharks that attack people in these beach areas where they're surfing and swimming and playing with the kids and everything else. That's all getting killed, but we're going to stop the, they're going to get rid of the sharks if we don't stop them from fishing for them. It's all smoke and mirrors for the agendas you were talking about, which gets back to what I was just saying a little earlier. I don't know what to suggest other than somehow creating or finding or whatever, a political representation, at least in countries like we have in Europe and North America and a few in Asia, where they've got a similar government. If you've got an autocracy in Africa or South America or something that's run by the same family year after year, what I'm talking about doesn't make any sense to them because you'll never get it like that. But we've got the opportunity to somehow create an elected responsibility to represent our mutual interests in rural America, rural Canada. Now, of course, it's easy to say, oh, Trudeau people have never used that or never allow that. Well, you can change those things over time, but you've got a goal that you're talking about in place that if you can get the right people elected at the right time to do this and put this in there, you can create this thing that would endure and not be a passing fad. And if you weren't being represented good in rural zones like I described, we're not going to elect you again in there, period.
Right,
you
know, right.
It's the only key that I think would work. And then you can start really talking about keeping the ranches there, keeping the fishing going on, and keeping the rural communities viable places where kids can stay and get jobs other than a school teacher or working in the gas station for their life, you know, and raise their own kids and everything. So it's a big problem. And we often talk about this segment of it and that segment of it, but it's going on all over, and it's been going on for 50 years. And mm-hmm. we can go back to the time when what's his name? Nixon was president. And there was the war problems. They didn't reelect Johnson. The environmentalists, the free love, the drug use and everything kind of took over. And all of a sudden we saw the emergence of these, the world's coming to an end if we don't do A, B, and C, whatever. So they voted in more laws affecting what you and I are talking about in the next 30 years than they had in the whole life of this country or even beyond. Mm-hmm. That gave the central government more and more tyrannical power, exercised by bureaucrats that all had hidden agendas and relatives that were in the NGOs that they were working with and going to the meetings with and plotting the lawsuits with and all of this stuff day in and day out. So it's like a snowball. It gets bigger and bigger as it rolls downhill, and it's picking up all these other things right now, the way the border is lied about and the way where the defense money, the strategic petroleum reserve is down to too low, but we're not going to talk about that. It's Putin, you know, and all of this stuff is all tangled up together, and making sense through it about what concerns us very deeply, the ranchers, all of the associated operations that go with them in town and in the county, and, you know, all of that business life and families and homes and schools and what makes America great. Got to have something to look up to. And I, other than what we're talking about, I've been suggesting lately, this idea of getting political representation for that purpose, elected persons for the purpose of renewable natural resources. That's the grasses, the trees, the ground covers, the logging, the hunting, the uses of them, so that you integrate a livable environment for all of these people and their things and the wildlife and the forests and the grasslands, and keep them not just in, oh, we'll make it part of the Forest Service, so we'll make the big old BLM bigger, we'll give them more authority. Well, you know, that's been shown
That's counterproductive. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Jim. You know, and what you're saying is something that a lot of people just don't get. They don't understand this. But a lot of the same people that you're talking about during Vietnam and in the 60s, the radicals in the on campus, the SDS, the Weathermen, all these radical Marxist groups, when there was no more war to fight about, they jumped on the green bandwagon big time. And that was really the start of the whole environmental movement in a big way, was when Vietnam ended and they didn't have a war to fight about. And it the same Marxists that were anti-war, and I don't get me wrong, I think Vietnam was a big mistake. So does just about everybody, because we now understand the politics that was behind it. But at the same time, this radical movement is the one that moved into the environmental groups. And prior to the, you know, prior to all these crazy environmental things going on, the sportsmen were the ones that had brought back most of the hunting and the fishing in big numbers across the United States. Because in the early 1900s, they had something called market hunting, where there was no limit on the amount of animals that were killed. They damn near wiped out the buffalo. They damn near wiped out different bird species. And so there was a real effort by sportsmen who wanted to hunt, who wanted to have access to a good, healthy, natural environment. And they're the ones that put up most of the money that brought elk herds back to the West, brought deer populations back, that did a lot of this stuff. So it was the sportsmen that were the ones that actually made things better. And that's where you're talking about Pittman Robertson. That was part of the funding was through that group that caused that to happen. Then why on earth are we allowing these anti-humanists? And that's what they are. They hate the human race. They want to make sure that humans are the species that gets reduced radically, and they want to increase the wildlife populations radically. I, you know, I'm getting kind of on subject but off subject. I want you to jump in there somewhere and tell me how you think about all that.
Well, I thought about it Sunday when I was re-watching the news, and they talked about Vice President Harris, who's a big abortion supporter, was at some sort of abortion soiree, you know, the anniversary of Roe Wade or whatever. And she quoted the preamble to the Declaration of Independence by dropping out the words in rights granted by God. Okay, God was taken out of there. That account for our inalienable rights to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. She dropped out the word life. I mean, I'm so startled, even as cynical as I am about all this stuff after these years of working, at the point we've reached where I could quote the Declaration of Independence, a magnificent achievement in world history, and just drop out the key words there and use it for something entirely different that contradicts what that document was. And I make another little observation about how we think about people and animals and animal rights mean they've got the rights we do and all of that stuff. I was at a meeting years ago, no, not that many, I guess, but a few years ago, in Nevada, a bunch of trappers. And I got a ride back to the airport from a guy who told me the following story. This guy was a government worker. He said, "Mr. Beers," he says, "it's worse than you think." He said, "Our waterfowl biologist in the regional office in California, that we've got a woman that's been put in charge of them, and she's all against hunting and having any water in these national wildlife refuges, because it's not natural and Dyke's got it going on. She's radical, but she can't play it out. So she's told the waterfowl biologist that looked after this refuge that he was not to do anything for waterfowl, period. Even though it was duck stamp money and the people you were talking about, they're responsible for getting that refuge made into a refuge, dikes built there, water pumped in there certain times of the year for food, everything as they migrate back and forth, and some reproduction. And he said when he didn't want to do it, but she thought he was doing it, but he said he wasn't, she sent Fish and Wildlife and law enforcement people into his office to seize his computer. It took his computer and started searching through it to see if he was disobeying. Now that's what's going on in there with people that are educated in the schools. That my alma mater was Utah State. 60 years ago now, that was an excellent school that was reasonably priced for a kid like me to get an education about wildlife management. And I worked for the Utah Game and Fish while I was out there. Wonderful time, wonderful people. I love Utah. Even though I'm from Illinois, I mean, I love Utah a lot. But anyway, Utah State, I got an alumni magazine one time about, this would have been about 15, 20 years ago, that said they were going to change the name of the College of Forest Range and Wildlife Management to the College of Environmental Concerns, Pollution, and International, some bull nonsense. But anyway, I didn't think that was a good idea at the time. That was back when I was trying to work within the system and believed in fairy tales and all that. So I wrote him a very nice letter, and I can write a nice letter when I want to, very good at detailing why I thought that was a wrong thing to do, because now more than ever, as we were shifting more and more away from wildlife management, forest management, and range management as legitimate fields of study and work, they said, as we're doing that, we need places like Utah State. Well, he sent me back the nastiest letter you ever saw, that I didn't know anything about universities, and until I've got some more degrees, this and that, blah, 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 blah. And anyway, I didn't get alumni magazines for about 2 years. Well, I'm on a radio program one night with a guy in Portland, Oregon. Well, Jimmy says, I see you went to Utah State. He said, it must have been something. And he says, it's a great school, wasn't it? I said, well, it used to be. I don't know about it anymore. He says, what do you mean? Well, I just told him the story I just told you. And he laughed and he said, holy cow. He said, I thought that they would take, how did he put it? Oh, I thought they didn't just do away with your alumni magazines. I thought they'd probably try to put some poison in your soup, he said, for doing stuff like you were trying to do with them. And I said, and he agreed. I said, the contempt he showed for me in his response and the cancellation of my alumni news, I said, I don't want anything to do with them anymore. About 2 weeks later, I got about a month-old copy of the alumni news, and I've been getting them ever since. So I'm back in good graces because somebody evidently heard that program that night out of Oregon, and something got said back at the university or maybe the state house or something, and it didn't look too good for the state, so they put me back on the alumni news. Not that there's much on there that I need to, that I get much out of anymore. But anyhow, those things are taking place, just like we're concerned about the way the kids are being educated. I mean, what are they going to be like when they're in high school and college, when they go out and get a job? What's this wokeism doing to the country? It's true of all of this stuff. And we're just one facet of it that's been there longer than a lot of the other ones.
Yeah. No, you're right. That's how they've done it. And frankly, just because you're a Western State University doesn't mean that they haven't, as you said, made big inroads into the curriculum and are actually modifying the curriculum. Montana State University, that my alum. I went there when it was, they called it MU, because it was mostly ag and engineering. And, they called it MU. Well, now it's one of the most liberal universities in the whole Western United States. and it's completely different. The town of Bozeman, I don't even recognize it anymore. As a matter of fact, you know, where we live in Pony, we prefer to go shopping in Butte, just because Bozeman has changed so much that it isn't even like the same town that it was 50 years ago.
Yeah. It's happening all over the country. It's happening all over the country. And when we think about what we can do about it, I mean, there's a lot of things that you do for a year or two, and I did a lot of them. It's like you've been running up against a brick wall and hitting your head. You're going to back up and hit your head again and say, I'm going to get through this thing, and, you know, you don't. So an answer, a solution, a suggestion, they're hard to come by without everyone going, oh, that can't work. Well, we got to make something work, and it's going to take some, I think, political focus of power that we have control of to do something about it. I really do.
Well, Jim, one of the keys, and this is something that's so important. We worked on, programs on UN Agenda 21. I worked with you on a couple of things that we did in the state on that subject. But one of the key things for rural counties to do, and very few of them have actually gone to the expense and the trouble to do that, and that is all these rural counties need to create a county-wide natural resource plan. And identifying the various resources in the county, and that means all of them, everything, and then putting together a plan on the best way to utilize those resources for the betterment of the people who live there. And Amen. if they do that, then they can go to a state group like you're talking about and create the governor can, start something like that. But you're right, it could be very much like a public service commission. In Montana, we've got 5 districts in Montana that have public service commissioners. You could do something very similar and call them natural resource commissioners. And in Montana, they're elected in their district. And you could do the same thing in with a natural resource commissioner. I'm not big on creating bureaucracy. I'm not big on creating agencies. But that's been the problem, is that we've not been so totally underrepresented in the rural communities compared to the urban communities that pretty much are right now the tail wagging the dog. And an awful lot of those people in the urban communities don't have a clue where food even comes from.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of sad. I mean, you know, it's like I use this as an example. There's nothing in the world better than taking some of these college kids that have all these radical environmental ideas. Let them work a ranch for a summer. Let them work on a ranch. Let them work on a farm, a family farm for a summer, and let them understand what good stewardship really is. Because the best stewards in the world are individuals who own property, because the smart ones know that they've got to be good stewards or they're not going to be able to use that property for productive means. And if they're bad stewards, they're going to go out of business, and then the good ones can buy them out. Just that simple.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's a good point about the public service commissioners. Mm-hmm. And the problem is the way things are structured right now, though, that all of the voters in the urban areas and the legislators and the governor and the bureaucrats in the Capitol all don't want what you and I are concerned with to have any say. They want to mm-hmm. be able to exercise what they do out there and what they will or won't have, or what they, you know, they've all got a little stake in that, and they just come together and they say, sure, we'll take care of you, pat us on the head, and then tell us to go on home, and they'll call us when it's time, and they never call. So
well, Let's look at this. You intrigue me. So let's put together the architecture for doing something like that. And I'm going to use Montana as a perfect example. Montana's got 56 counties in the state. And let's say that we've got, set it up like a public service commission where there's maybe five commissioners that are, instead of public service, they're natural resource commissioners, okay? So they take a particular district, and you can figure out geographically a way to do that, but certainly natural resources in Montana used to be a big deal. And frankly, that's the reason we've gone from, in 1960, we were a natural resource state. We mined, we logged, we ranched, we farmed, we did everything with natural resources. And we were number six in the United States in per capita income. Right now, the environmental groups have pretty much put a chokehold on mining and logging, and now they're doing it on ranching. And Montana is number 48 or 49, depending on the year, in per capita income. They're one of the lowest per capita income of anywhere in the United States. And the reason is we no longer use our natural resources. So let's set this up like a public service situation. Jim, are you with me on that?
I follow you right along.
Okay, I'll talk you through this. 56 counties in the state of Montana. So let's say that of those 56 counties, there's probably seven or eight that would be considered urban counties. The rest would be rural counties. So let's say we'll use round numbers here. Let's say that there's 16 counties, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt, 16 counties that could be considered urban and 40 counties that could be considered rural counties. If each one of these counties has a natural resource plan, they all are required to put together a natural resource plan, okay? And each one of these counties, as part of that natural resource plan, they have the county commissioners in each of those counties are the final authority on natural resource plans, okay? They bring this information to this elected group. And it's like you say, let's make it a thing like the Public Service Commission. Let's say there's five districts in the state of Montana. Of those districts, chances are at least three or four of them are going to be rural counties because you do it by county. You got so much area in each county, and that's where all the resources are. So let's just say that 40 of those counties are rural counties and 16 are urban counties. That would put your numbers pretty close. That would mean that let's say four of those districts are urban or rural and one is urban. Let's just say that's kind of how it all works. With that, then you would have fair representation of the rural counties because each county would have a particular natural resource plan and a certain say through their county commissioners in the information that goes forward to the natural resource group. What do you think about how we could structure that?
Well, I think it works good with what you're talking about, but I think doing something, changing some things in the state, you'd benefit from having one head commissioner on the board in the capital and in excluding the urban areas. You talk about counties that have urban areas in them and only making it for the rural counties, because you do that on the justification that these are renewable natural resources and we want to represent the people and the communities and the businesses that are in those areas, whether it's for trees or grazing or whatever. And in the case of Montana, I think you've got a beautiful three or four commissioner areas like you talk about, excluding those urban counties. You've got the mountains there in the west, and the whole, all the problems with the valleys and mining and everything else. And you've got the prairies in the east coming in from the Dakotas and that, and up from Wyoming. And then you've got the middle ground there with the Missouri River, all kinds of other things where people have common interests up in Malta. They have a lot, mm-hmm. a lot of common interests with people maybe over in Plentywood or not, but you got three or four areas. And if each of those, you had that county plan put together and I elected a guy who, along with a guy or gal elected in the capital as kind of the head of their commission, can really nudge and lobby and hope to influence the legislature and the governor and the attorney general and the others, and work with them to mm-hmm. implement renewable natural resource management and use most desired by those living with it, in order to preserve the human element and the wild resource elements in perpetuity, mm-hmm. that they integrate themselves and they benefit, mutual benefit and maintenance, and not allow the Wildlife Federation and the Center for Biological Diversity to buy a couple of the guys in the legislature and influence them, or some rich guy in Montana to get his own guy elected over there so that they could block anything that blocks what they want to do, when you'd have some power that represented what that area of the state really wants to do. And mm-hmm. you'd have these guys trying to effect that, not just asking the legislatures and the governor to look at our plans and look at, they all say this, but to actually work with those people in a one-on-one, and maybe even have power to occasionally veto certain things unless they can get a change, a modification made that represents those people. And I think it's the only thing that seems to maybe hold out change. It's one thing to have representation and that and a lot of plans, but somebody with change that gets elected into those jobs, and if you don't stand up and you're too busy taking care of your garden, we'll get somebody else in there that will. And over mm-hmm. time, reverse things or get things going in a little different direction at the university and with certain kinds of business functions and what they're doing or not doing. And let the urban, you know, those rural counties don't try to impose themselves on the urban counties. I mean, that sounds mm-hmm. silly. In every state, you'd laugh. What do they know? You know, well, you've got the opposite going on. San Francisco and Los Angeles are imposing themselves on the whole state of California. Chicago, right. On Illinois. And they laugh that, you know, well, of course I want Buffalo running around central Illinois. Of course we've got to do more with our streams and close them to any use and have big buffer zones for 600 yards in every direction, blah, 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 blah. You know.
Jim, I couldn't agree with you more, but I'm going to use the Public Service Commission in Montana as an example. We've got five commissioners in the state of Montana for the Public Service Commission. All counties, including urban counties, are in those districts, right. And yet we've got five Republicans that are actually elected in the Public Service Commission. Five out of five are Republicans, and I would say at least three of them, if not four, are true conservatives. So that shows the power that you can do if you let every county have an equal voice in the process. And that's kind of what I'm saying. Do it in a way that the counties, the geographic areas, have equal voice. They have one representative or one guy from each county that has a voice to go to this commission. And it's the way our founders envisioned in the first place, because that's why we're a republic and not a democracy. the reason they didn't want us to be a democracy is because they could see this happening. A few very powerful urban states being the tail that wagged the dog. And that's why we have an electoral college. Yep. It's why we have a process of precincts in the counties, and we have precinct positions in the counties. We have state and then county political entities. If we use the power that the founding fathers gave us, we would put an end to the big urban areas being the tail that wags the dog. And I had this very same discussion with General Michael Flynn on an email discussion back and forth with him, and he agreed with me. Wow. He said that is the way to do it, is to go to the individual county level, empower your central committees, and get the precinct level being involved. So like I'm going to use Madison County as an example. I've been either the chairman or the finance chair of the Madison Republicans for almost since Christ was a corporal. It's been too long. But anyway, we've got 7 voting precincts in our county. If you have 2 people in each precinct, a precinct captain and a co-captain, usually it's a husband and wife, but it can be anything, and fill all those positions with all the voting members. When you go to the state convention every summer, you've got in Montana, like I said, probably 50 of the 56 counties are really what you call a rural county. They have a huge voting block, and they have a lot more power at the state convention than these urban counties have. That's the way we've got to take our country back, is using what our founding fathers gave us. And that is local governments being the most powerful, the most important, and then filling those positions with good quality elected people. If we do that, we can win our country back. And I look at what's happening with, let's just say New York City or San Francisco or whatever. You take a look at how much power they've got now. They're literally running the whole process, and they shouldn't. If we go back to the way our country was founded, the urban counties would have much less power than the rural counties.
Well, I'm glad to rethink it and take all that into consideration, because old Flynn is one of my heroes. The fact that he would be thinking about that being a good thing is very impressive to me. So, yeah, but we got to get together, and we all of us got to get together and come up with some way to have action, and it's got to be political action.
Mm-hmm. Well, our founders. We just need to go back to the power that our founding fathers gave us. And that is that every individual is sovereign, and the individual, then the next step up is local governments, be it county commissions or, city governments, whatever. And then it goes to the state capital. The federal government is completely taken over the role of controlling people, and that's absolutely the exact opposite of what our founders envisioned. And frankly, that's why for the last 100 years, our presidents have been talking about us being a democracy. They know a hell of a lot better than that. They know we're a constitutional republic. They want us to be a democracy, because then it can be mob rule. And that's exactly what we've got right now in this country, is mob rule.
Yep. Yeah, you're right there. But there's a lot of issues too that are international issues now, that we got to have our federal government change in such a way that they're not as beholden to them, because the bureaucrats at the national level, the bureaucrats in the UN, the bureaucrats at CITES, and now these World Economic Forum messengers like Kerry and the rest of them, they've got a whole other ball of wax they want to impose on everybody else. And we've got to have people that will oppose that. and stand up to it. That's how important all this is. It's not just local. It's not just Montana. It's not just the West or the South or anything like that. It's the whole nation and the rest of the world, really, and how we interact with it. I do a lot of exchange of information with people in Africa and in Australia, too. And they're concerned about the same basic matters we are, about how there's just this avalanche of regulation and bans on hunting and trophies being shipped, or you can't do anything with this animal. You need a permit from us for that, and we're not going to give it to you. And we're going to list more stuff. And our bureaucrats and all of those international bureaucrats and all have now a big stake in it, building up their numbers and their budgets and everything else to do things that are totally out of our control and are not in any way concerned about our welfare, either our natural resources welfare or our human welfare or our economic welfare. They're not concerned with that. In fact, most of those things they want to eventually exploit on their own and enjoy on their own when they get rid of the rest of us. So, yeah, that's a good, I hear what you're saying. I'm going to be giving that a lot of thought and maybe mentioning it if I can. But it's, like you say, it's hard. A lot of people don't understand the larger issue that we're dealing with. And that's kind of where we're at.
Well, Pogo says it's recognizing that we're looking for the enemy and the enemy is us.
Yeah.
Our biggest problem is mis and disinformation and not recognizing that we have a tremendous amount of power that's just not used. You know, the American people, if they would just get off their butt and be part of the process of re-republicanizing, and I'm not saying big R Republican. I'm talking being a small R Republic, because frankly, I think the Republican Party is almost as big a problem as a Democrat Party. I use this analogy, and I've used it many times. It's like they say, well, it's like the Democrats are in a car and they got their foot to the floor and they're driving as fast as they can into socialism or Marxism. And I say, yeah, and the Republicans are behind them in another car. They're just trying to drive the speed limit.
That's true. That's true. It's a good analogy. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good.
Anyway.
Some good ideas here from our conversation. And I'm really happy. Made some notes, and this has really, really been a good exchange as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. So,
well, yeah. You know, we've got the power. We just need to learn how to utilize it. And rural people, for the most part, are people who, they work hard. They don't have a lot of time. Even though most of the rural schools, and I can tell you, I live in, our school district is Harrison, Montana. Our kids are some of the smartest kids in the state when you get looking at SATs and things like that. They're some of the smartest kids in the state. They're ranch kids. You know, they've got a little bit of discipline, but at the same time, their primary focus is on just being decent, good students, but they're busy making a living, so they don't have a chance to get involved in a lot of things that the city kids get involved in, which is positive, frankly. You know, they're a lot less likely to spend their sit on their butt on the couch playing video games all day. They're up digging post holes and branded cattle and things like that, which is a heck of a lot better for your mind. But anyway, my comment on that is that the rural people need to realize that we are in World War III against the rural environment. And the ultimate goal, and you know this, and I'd love to have you really amplify on this, the ultimate goal is to reduce the world's population by a very large percentage, as high as 90 or 95%, they're saying. and move the rest of humanity into megacities where they can be controlled. Now, you said something about travel, you know, not being able to travel. That's a big deal. People don't realize that's part of Agenda 21, part of Agenda 2030. They want us to be tied to an urban area where we're dependent on either bicycles, foot traffic, or electric vehicles that are provided by the state. Talk about this urbanization that they want to do.
Yeah, you're correct that they're doing all kinds of wild things, and it mystifies me how unaware we are. The price of gasoline is going back up again dramatically. Mm-hmm. We've drained down our strategic petroleum reserve. While we could be at some kind of conflagration with China or Russia or Iran in the near future, and we don't have the kind of oil reserves we had. We've let the states, the federal government, do away with the federal gas tax, and that is, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to repair the roads or build new roads or do the bridges? Nobody seems to care. And our governor here in Minnesota is bragging about a big budget surplus they got, and one of the things he's going to do is he's going to go after the state's infrastructure, which is in poor. Well, he and the rest of them have all backed up and voted to keep, not collect the taxes anymore. So people don't see that. They just see the price of the gas and kind of wonder and grumble about it and pay it and go on about their business. And the things that we're talking about here, I'm sure that those ranch kids, I mean, I was given a talk once in rural Oregon, and I stayed at a ranch with a real nice lady that just a good cook and everything else. And she told me there was a little bookstore in a nearby town that, you know, if I wanted, I told her I like to look at get books and everything. And she said, why don't you go over there and see, take a look. So I could drive in there, and it's a nice bookstore, good books in it, not real big. But there's these three Mormon mothers and mm-hmm. about 9 or 10 kids. And they were homeschooling those kids while they ran the little bookstore, which I don't think was ever busy, but which people came in and out from and whatever. And the kids came over and started talking to me about what I was here to talk about or do. And they were all very interested. And they were all like little mature people. I mean, mm-hmm. you'd think that they're really in their 30s or 40s or 50s, honestly. Yes, sir, and no, well, really, what about this, that, the other thing? And I realized that it was that homeschooling, it was that rural background that was raising kids there that were the finest you could ever want to meet anywhere in the United States. And you're right about them, and God bless them, and I hope I can do all I can for them. But it's very true that a lot of people don't understand what's going on or don't seem to care. And especially here in Minnesota, if you bring up some of these things in most gatherings, you're going to have a lot of people get really upset and want to argue with you and call you names and other things. So, and I'm not saying that to downgrade Minnesota, but there's a lot of places all over the country like that, even in some of the red states and certain towns or whatever. So wending our way through this political maelstrom that we're in the middle of right now, and coming out on the other end with something positive like we're talking about here, I think is a very worthy pursuit for all of us.
Yeah, I do too. And Jim, the reason I brought up the Public Service Commission and the, you know, the county structures and things like that, if you go look at counties around the United States, take a look at, pull up the counties, how they voted in the last presidential election. That's a perfect example. How they voted in the last presidential election by county, and you'll see how many red counties there are. I mean, Jim, it makes up probably 7/8 or certainly 3/4 of the United States is made up by red counties. And that's why I'm saying if we do this with the county structure that our founding fathers gave us and the idea that we, you know, local government is the best government, we don't have to exclude the cities from the discussion on natural resources. We can include them, and we still hold a significant majority, and maybe we can educate some of these dumbasses on using natural resources in a productive and intelligent way. Because most of the city people, it isn't that they're uninformed as much as they're misinformed. They don't understand how rural people live, and they don't understand how food is produced or so many other natural resources. You can talk about something as simple as carbon. You know, here we got all these nitwits that are talking about carbon sequestration. The best way to sequester carbon isn't to leave forests untended and let them literally fall over and because they're so full of disease and, you know, they've got parasites, they've got all these problems. The best way to utilize a forest is to harvest it and use it for products that we use every day. That's carbon sequestration, and it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and you're 100% right, and I know right what you're saying. And the job is to convince people that have power in the government structure we live under to recognize that and behave accordingly, and let guys like Kerry stay home on their sail surfboards and, you know, not be flying all over the country spreading just the opposite kind of information. Yeah.
Well, I'm working with Debbie Boskalupi, and we're going to be doing a article for Range Magazine. But it's funny because I had Mark Baird. I think you probably have met Mark. He's from Northern California. He's the gentleman that put together the State of Jefferson movement.
I believe I did meet him. Yes, yes.
Yeah, super good guy. He was a commercial pilot. He flew all these bigwigs all over the world, and he's been to Davos to the World Economic Forum meetings, and he said you would be astounded. He said this year they had, and I'm not sure if he flew there or if he just has friends that are still pilots that are flying there, they had something like 1,300 gigantic private jets flew into Davos to the World Economic Forum. 1,300. They had to take over three airports to have enough room to accommodate all these private jets that were flying in. These are the same people that are telling us we've got to eat bugs. We need to quit eating meat. We need to start eating bugs. When we start listening to that kind of bullshit, and from those kind of people. Debbie talked about it in Cairo at the COP27 conference. She said they introduced a meal there that was engineered chicken. Okay. It was not real chicken. It was something that they produced through some kind of biomass engineering crap. Anyway, she said, and it was funny because that was the one meal they had there. Most of the people that were bigwigs at the COP27 conference didn't eat it. It was just the little people that had to eat this crap. And it is so typical of this whole movement. The hypocrites are the ones that are putting together all these programs for the rest of us that we have to live by. It's time that we take over the whole system again, isn't it?
You bet. That's exactly right. It's a good phrase. We need to retake the old system. Yep. Reinstate it. That's right.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. You know, the only thing bad about the old system is that it's a natural thing, but it provided the liberty for the dumbasses to take over because they were more determined to destroy it than we were to save it. Now we've got to re-energize ourselves to be the ones to save it. That's just that simple.
Yep. You're right.
Well, Jim, talk a little about some of the projects that you do. And I know You've done, I talked to C.J. Havlis. You've done a number of articles for Range Magazine in the past. I think she's, you know, she's interested in seeing what you come up with in the future. So, you know, that that may be another new connection. But anyway, talk a little bit about some of the things. You write great newsletters. I get your newsletters, and they're fantastic.
Well, I guess I'm mostly thinking about this long-term solution like you and I have been discussing here. But then every so often I get a newspaper article or a talk that somebody makes, and I get a copy of it and I look at it and I get so upset that I sit there and I try to make out an article that's not too long that explains why these guys are full of malarkey and what they're really up to and what it's really going to cost. And, you know, explain that to people, kind of like you and I have been agreeing that, yeah, we need to get people to understand things. And I do that the best I can. But I don't get on Facebook or Twitter or any of those because I've stayed off of them because I never trusted them from the get-go. And I've done myself harm. But a lot of people who get my things that I write have asked for, well, they've all asked for it, and they share it with other people. So I try to explain about what's going on with the Irish fishing fleet and why they're, why they're so upset with their government, because their government didn't represent them in the talks with Northern Ireland and England about redoing the quotas now that Brexit's taken place. And that's simply because the Irish federal government just doesn't care enough about them because they're kind of small, kind of like ranchers in a certain state or something. Oh, yeah, we'll take care of you, but they didn't. And they need somebody looking after them at the government level that represents those people. So I tried to explain that and put it in terminology a lot like we've kind of arrived at here this afternoon or this morning on the things we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So that pretty well takes up my time, and I do a lot of volunteer work around here where I live, and my wife and I stick pretty close to home now with the way the gas prices are and a lot of the crime that's going on too. I live on the fringes of the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and we have a lot of crime here, although we're not quite in the league yet of Philadelphia and New York City and LA. You know, it's for an old couple kind of just tootling around town, you got to be a little careful about it. So, but other than that, life is good. I mean, paying high prices like everybody else, looking for good food and, you know, trying to make our money go far enough to take care of things. But so far we've been pretty blessed, and we're getting up there in age. I don't like to admit that, but it's true. So,
yeah. Well, we all are. It's part of the natural process. Jim, what give people, if you want, give people a website that they can go to sign up for newsletters or information from you?
I had three attempts at keeping a website up, and I had to give it up. It was too much trouble.
They were crashing
other people
it.
Getting in there. Mm-hmm. I'll write people things or send them a copy of something when I write it, along with other people. And if you want to, just tell me that you want to get it all the time. And if you don't, you can stop it at any time. I'll take your name off. I don't sell it. I don't advertise anything. And so my email address is jimbeers, JIMBEERS, number7@comcast.net. That's jimbeers7@comcast.net. And I've got several things I've written in the last few days, and hopefully I'll write some more in the next few weeks. And if you write me at any time, I'll send you a couple that I've recently done or something. And if you want to get it, fine. So anyway, well, that's my attempt at doing what you and I say is important. So,
well, I know that you're a terrific writer. You've done thousands of different articles. And so I recommend people go to jimbeers7@comcast.net and ask Jim to send you a newsletter when his go out. Jim, thank you for being our guest. I'm sorry we had so much trouble.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're still having it. Frankly, they didn't want you to get together with me, because we are old friends, and we've done some seriously good work together over the years, so I'm happy with that. But thank you again for being our guest.
From the lakes of Minnesota
to the hills of Tennessee,
across the plains of Texas, oh, from sea to shining sea,
from Detroit down to Houston,
New York to LA,
where there's pride in every American heart,
and it's time we stand and say.
There ain't no doubt.